From our headquarters in Oslo, Norway, and on behalf of our host, Robbie Peralta, welcome to the Mnemonic Security Podcast.
By now, you've probably understood that privacy is a myth as long as you have a phone in your pocket. But what if, and this is a big if, what if you could really control what your phone is sharing about you? For example, what if you could control which data you share, when you want to share it, and most importantly, with whom? And wouldn't it be nice if you could also control the whole thing from your phone too? A true trusted digital agency. Now, I wouldn't be asking Santa this for Christmas, but there is actually a very large and powerful group of people that are putting their heads together to figure this out. In fact, the World Economic Forum has dedicated a task force to solving this issue, and today we are joined by the global security strategist of Checkpoint, who also happens to be a delegate and constituent of this task force, along with a bunch of other names like Facebook, Microsoft, Palantir. You get the point. Eddie Doyle, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Robbie. How are you, man?
I'm doing fantastic. How about yourself?
Superb. I'm doing well. Now, listen, we are both talking from snowy regions because despite my deft New York accent, joking, I live in New Jersey. Looking out my window right now, there's tons of snow. So I think we have a brotherhood there, don't we? Aren't you sitting in the snow?
I would love to be sitting in the snow, but everything melted. It's actually 8 degrees Celsius, which is, I have no idea what that is anymore, but like 45. It's actually warm here.
Hey, I'm a Brit man, so Celsius is good for me. I lived in Canada, so I lived in the Rocky Mountains of Canada for 25 years, married a Canadian girl. So I know proper temperatures, right? Minus 30s. I've skied in minus 37, so that's my big claim to fame.
Nice, nice. So let's start out there. Who are you? Why are you in Canada and you're from the... You're Brit, you're living in the US?
And I've got a French passport. Yeah, I've got a French passport too. Okay, well, look, I mean, the story is just a kid growing up in a little village in England. And I went to university in Manchester, studied sport medicine of all things, right? I don't know. And I'm in cyber. Actually, I dropped out of sport med, went to take an English teacher certificate, became an English teacher, moved to Canada on a whim. Just knew some people. Actually, it was an accident because I met some folks while in my last year of university that said, hey, we're from Calgary. And I thought they meant Calgary, Scotland. And they said, do you want to come up for a visit? And I said, oh, sure, yeah, I'll come for a visit. And I was too embarrassed because I was just a dumb kid, 21 years old. Right? When I realized my geographic mistake, they were talking about Calgary, Canada, the other side of the Atlantic Ocean. I wanted to brass it out. I didn't want to tell people, hey, I didn't know that. So I had to sell my 1969 Volkswagen Beetle for a plane ticket to get to Canada. And when I got there, I stayed. 25 years. So I taught English for a little while, but I got into technology because, look, just after the dot-com bubble burst, everybody was talking about technology. And it just looked so much fun. And I had friends in technology. And it's just... let me into technology. So I got into actually the sales and marketing side of technology, fixed wireless communication. And so I worked for a company that did fixed wireless internet communication. We were able to build OC3 rings. I mean, huge speed, 155 meg. That was huge speed for those days. And that just, over 10 years, made me somewhat technical. And I fell into cybersecurity because what I observed is the people inside the rack spaces that we were selling kept getting compromised. And I thought, well, this is interesting. What's this about, right? You know, how are people breaking in? And so I just got attracted to the industry, joined a company called Checkpoint Software Technology, simply because, you know, I like the way the Israelis have done it. They've built some good technology, right? They're world leaders in that technology. It's a very engineered, driven company. It was very refreshing for me to represent a product that was rock solid. I jumped, did a startup in the Valley, and then came back to Checkpoint. And I've been in cybersecurity for about 15 years now. So that's my journey in a nutshell, my friend.
You fit your role. I'll tell you that right now. That's for sure.
It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun, you know.
Today, I have one specific question for you. And it's I've been having a lot of episodes lately about privacy and about our phones and, you know, all the apps being shared and all that. And obviously, you're the global security strategist for Checkpoint, which is... really awesome. I know that you're part of a lot of really interesting conversations there, but you have another title, and that's what I asked you more about today, and that one is the delegate and constituent for the Task Force on Data Intermediaries.
Yeah, for the World Economic Forum.
So let's dive into that. How about you tell us, first of all, why does the World Economic Forum care about cybersecurity, and what is this task force? that you're on?
It's part of that maturing that I was just talking about, really, you know, because we're starting to see global disruption, we've seen much global disruption from, you know, cyber threats. So let's take an old case, NotPetya, right? You know, we can take NotPetya. In fact, when the Russian GRU, so that's the their version of the NSA or GCHQ, right? When they cyber attacked the country of Ukraine, they were able to shut down banking infrastructure. Now it's like, wow, right? That critical infrastructure. Now, of course, that attack spilled out over the world, and it cost companies hundreds of millions. Some companies, there's a pharmaceutical company in New Jersey here, cost them $1 billion in damages. They were down for 2 weeks, using fax machines for 2 weeks. Wow. And so the World Economic Forum, obviously, right, that's why, right? That's why they're involved in this. That's the larger picture of why they're involved with this. The committee that I sit on is on data privacy. And data privacy is simply, look, Tim Cook and Mark Zuckerberg in the news recently. So this is what we are, this is the scenario that we're talking about. And GDPR was, of course, launched in Europe, as you're aware, in an attempt to solve these kinds of problems. But my understanding is Tim Cook, I think it was last month or at the beginning of this month, he was in, I think it was Germany, but he made this very impactful statement. It was a very clever statement too, because he did not mention Facebook's name. But he said something along the lines of, you know, algorithms are not good for humanity. Algorithms that basically seek to take people's personal data and sell them as the product. Now, and that is Facebook's business model. Of course, right? You know, Facebook is a media company that produces no media. Largest media company in the world, but they produce no media. LinkedIn is very similar, right? Owned by Microsoft today. LinkedIn, again, another information company that I think sold for either $4 or $6 billion, and yet they produce no information. So we as a society have voluntarily given up this information. And I used to say, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, right, that complaining about it is kind of like the cow complaining how the steak gets served. You're the steak, right? You're being carved up and being used. If you're not aware of that, too bad for you. Don't complain. That's too harsh, because I've fallen into the IT industry. You know my background. Had I stayed in sports medicine and, I don't know, opened up a gym, maybe I wouldn't have understood that. And for the people that don't understand that, for the people that did voluntarily give up that information, I think of my 90-year-old father and 80-year-old mother. Yeah, that's a problem. And that's why I sit on this particular committee at the Economic Forum, because those people need to be informed. This is incredibly problematic. GDPR has attempted to solve this problem, but I'm on the fence as far as whether I'm a fan of GDPR or not. Something needs to be done. But when you give it to politicians, people aren't going to like this statement, or at least politicians won't. When you give it to politicians, they create a stack of paper this high. And it's like, really? Who's going through this? How you've done exactly the same thing. You have created complexity to an audience, the 80s and 90-year-olds, and people who just aren't technically apt, right? It's not just old people. You've created another complex problem to try and, as a solution to a complex problem. So this doesn't work, right? It just doesn't work. Also, you know, there's of course no global standard. Yeah, of course. It's nice to have a European standard. That's kind of interesting, right? So how can we roll that out globally? That's what the World Economic Forum is attempting to actualize. And so the reason why, though, it's such an issue is simply because how do we communicate to a person that anything you say online, number one, is there forever, and if they do, who owns them? So if I said something stupid, if you said something stupid 10 years ago, who owns that piece of information? Right? That's part of me. And surely, any maturing that you or I have done is also part of me and should be part of that narrative. But these things are broken up into multiple snippets of information and weaponized against people. Okay, so that's one thing. The other problem that we have with consent is, how do we inform people of using their information? And when we create these big GDPR documents, now you have to have pages and pages and pages of consent. Well, no one's reading it, are they? It was kind of like back in the day, and this is where Apple was right, where Apple was actually guilty of this themselves. They've become quite good in this, but they were guilty quite a few years ago. So you remember when you wanted to get iTunes? And that's where all the music was going, so this is really cool. And there was 50 pages of terms and conditions. We'd all just clicked accept. Actually, it didn't hold up in court in a couple of cases in the US where people said, where essentially the judge said, look, informed consent needs to be something people are capable of understanding. Right. And 50 pages of legal terms and conditions is not what the average, not even what I can truly understand, right? My general counsel at work is the person that understands them, right? So, so this doesn't fit. So we're trying to solve that problem by using a community of people like me around the world to contribute to a dialogue so that we can come up with a much more, a much better understanding for people to either give or not give consent. Now, in the future, I think blockchain is going to solve this problem for us.
Right now, that consent, right? That's that. Those are those things that you have to click on every single time you go into a website, right? Those little consent things, or the cookies. You have to accept the cookies. Yeah. That's how the consent's been managed.
Because we forced companies to do that. And all the all these companies are doing. Companies have legal counsels, right? They have general counsels. So they know, I don't want to quite say how to get around these problems, but they know how to deal with problems with the minimal impact to the company, as they should. Companies are out there to make a profit, right? I'm not saying at any cost, but they are out there to sell their services. So they have to now put, because law has told them, you need to get consent. So what they do is they put up all of these little, will you accept the cookies, or here are our terms and conditions, or here's a link to the terms and conditions, which no one clicks on because there's the 50 pages, right? And all they're doing is they're heaping the responsibility that government and law have given them onto the end user. They've just passed the ball. That's all that's really happened there.
I looked onto this task force. I just went onto the website, and it says, blah, 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 the last sentence. Our platform focuses on maximizing data use to benefit society while protecting users from risks associated with the data economy. But they said our platform. And then, so, okay, that makes me think that, you know, they're making some sort of platform. And I looked at the companies that are part of this, organizations that are part of it. Checkpoint's a part of it. Great. Facebook, surprising. Microsoft, Palantir. Yeah, so what's the whole point? Are you trying to make a consent sort of platform so end users can manage the consent towards the companies?
Well, so let me pick up on you saying Facebook, surprisingly. It appears a surprise because, yes, they're in the business of selling your data, right? That's the only thing they've actually got to sell. And so it's not surprising that they would be there, but they're not there to stop selling your data. They're there to ensure that this will keep happening, and they know full well that there is resistance to this. So they want to be part of the story to influence it in a certain direction. Not necessarily
protecting their interest,
saying that's
right?
bad. It's not. They are protecting their interests. It's not entirely a bad thing. I can't just crap all over Facebook, because the reality is it's very cool that if I want to volunteer my data. And let's say, for example, I'm talking to you through these headphones. And so I'm searching for headphones and I start to see ads on my Facebook profile for headphones. I actually find that quite useful, right? I don't find that intrusive, me personally, right? I think that's fine. I have a dog, right? So if I'm looking for a new type of dog food, I like the fact that I have a variety of different dog foods come up in ads to me. So I actually think that's amazing, and it's a lot better than sitting through old school cable TV and seeing a bunch of ads that aren't relevant to you. So Facebook has actually solved a very, very good problem for us. It's the same with Google. I think more people watch YouTube today by far than cable TV. I mean, these companies are archaic and going away. Right? If they're not streaming, they're going away, cable TV. And so I like the fact that my ads are tailored for me. So this is a good thing. But blockchain, that's what I was going to talk about. Right. So, but what I want to know is there is some data that I do want to keep private. This is where I think blockchain will help us. And to answer your question, it's the World Economic Forum is not building an application or building a platform. No, what they are doing is saying, can we standardize on a set of rules so that companies like Facebook can build a platform to protect people's data? This is where I think blockchain is going to save us. I'll give you an example. I mentioned I moved to Canada, so I'm also a Canadian citizen. I lived there for 25 years. Snowboarded, I love snowboarding. Broke an arm, broke a leg, got a concussion, right? Busted my nose up, all sorts of stuff. Because you're a snowboarder and you're a 20-year-old punk kid, yeah. Right? Now, I've moved to the United States. Now, I have problems. I'm getting older, buddy. It's going to happen to you, Ravi. And all of these breaks are coming back to haunt me, right? And I'm sore now. So I went to my doctor's office and I said, I've got this problem in my elbow, my knee hurts, my hips, right? Back of my head. Okay. So he wants to have a look at my medical history. Now, it's only 5 years that I moved back to the United States. And I've made a request for these medical documents back where I used to live in Alberta, Canada. Can't find them. They're likely paper documents sitting in a box in a basement somewhere. And no one can get them. Well, this is a real issue for me. And it started making me think, why does my healthcare data, number one, live on paper? Okay, it's being digitized today. But we should certainly go back and digitize all that old stuff, just like we did with pretty much every book in the world. We've scanned and copied and digitized. So that's the first thing. And then I want to be able to carry that data with me wherever I go. It belongs to me. It's incredibly personal, right? I mean, what if I have an aneurysm, from having a traumatic brain injury? I mean, this is a very big deal. It's incredibly important. So blockchain will be able to give the ability of Edwin Doyle, this is him, he's very unique, this is his blockchain, this is him, it can't be tampered with, it's in the block, okay? And this is his healthcare portion of the blockchain. And when I go to my healthcare provider, I should be able to give consent to access this piece of Eddie Doyle, right? My healthcare piece of the blockchain. And I think industry, people who are a heck of a lot smarter than me, should be able to do the same thing. It's like, hey, Facebook, you don't get access to my healthcare data, right? Mm. That piece belongs to me. But if industry, through this effort at the World Economic Forum, can say, and I think this would be a reasonable request, and I think Facebook could still be a multi-billion dollar company. They don't need to be nearly as stressed out as they are about what Apple did with iOS recently on blocking ads. I think they can still be very successful by saying, yeah, fair enough, right? That's very personal data to you, Eddie, my banking information, right? I have to wire money from Canada to the US. It's a real pain, right? If that was in my blockchain and I was able to press a button, make sure it was secure, that thing will be done. Bitcoin's going to solve that for us at some point too. But Facebook, you don't get access to my financial history, right? How much money I earn, et cetera, et cetera. And so this, I think, the technology is likely there. I'm not the hands-on guy, so I'm not entirely sure. So what should come out of the policy that we're building on the data intermediary policy that we're building for this task force is a set of guidelines for some great companies to come along and say, okay, I can build that. And wow, that'd be fantastic. That'd be a game changer for us. Yeah.
For sure. So I'm just sitting here thinking, like, how would the platform, how would this sort of vision actually end up affecting the way I use social media sites? And because right now, this phone right now, if we were to put like a little tracking device, there's all the, I don't know how many apps I have, but they're all sharing where I'm at right now. Some of them aren't. But how would that, for normal people, like how would this affect our lives? Like for my friends that don't know, like, you mentioned your example earlier, it's like our parents, they don't know, they're not aware of all this they're just sharing, but I am, and you are. So how is this going to affect us? How is it going to like change our life and make, give us those products that we want, but also not?
We're building the plane as we fly in technology, and we've had to. If you kind of look at the history of TCP over IP, which is the internet, right? So in 1983, it was actually DARPA, which is the US, I forget what the acronym stands for, DARPA, but it's the US, it's the Pentagon sort of research and development scientific branch. This is where they've got, robots doing incredible things, right? And so DARPA looked at, how do we build a military grade, redundant, robust communication system for our soldiers. They created this thing called TCP over IP. That was 1983. Mm. Then that British chap, Tim something or other, at CERN in Switzerland, took that code and created the World Wide Web. And that was around 1989, I think, something like that, so the very late 80s. And all of a sudden, the internet was birthed. And back in those days, I mean, this is how wild, wild west it got. Back in those days, even banks, and you might be a little bit young to remember this, but there was like a telephone receiver, and you put the telephone, it was actual telephone wire, right? And and you dumped it onto a modem, and you were plugged in. That's how you plugged into the matrix, right? Into the intranet. Mm. And banks just went online like this. No security, right? Anyone could have tapped it back in those days. And you think about people, the famous people like Steve Jobs and Wozniak, right? They're a couple of hackers. Because what they were actually doing, their first product was a hacking product. I mean, this is how wild it was. It was socially acceptable. Is that right? I don't know if it was really socially acceptable. But the first product that Wozniak and Jobs sold was a hacking device to make free long-distance phone calls. Because what they figured out was there were certain tones, whistles, for want of better words, that's what it sounded like, that the phone companies used to route calls. And they figured out a device that you could plug in to deceive the phone company into getting free long-distance phone calls. So they created this thing, and it was fun, and it was just the way technology got started. Really bizarre to think about that now, right? But this was a legitimate product, right? That was doing something, I'm guessing it was illegal, I would think it would have been. That
the telephone companies didn't like it openly.
And then and then they got into, of course, you know, building Apple, and the rest is history, and there's some beautiful and amazing company. Now, so these things happened, and we continue to create the plane as we fly. You know, it was too fast for people to truly understand. And so today we're still having these kinds of problems where people grab an app and they go, oh, that's really cool. Right? One big mistake people should avoid right away, just to have a little bit of practical advice, is, you know, don't use Google to sign in for multiple things. You know how you get a new app and it says use Google to sign in? Don't do that. And unless you don't mind the information sharing. But the reason that happens is because information shares between all the apps, as you said, right? So don't do that. Now, these apps still also continue to share information. It's very difficult to stop this because there's no granular control for it to the end user. And look, there's actually good reason by some of these app manufacturers for not giving granular control. If you remember when cell phones were before they were real smartphones and they were kind of half smart, let's say, a PDA, you could adjust everything in the PDA, the font, the background color, the color of the fonts on the screen. And I mean, there was so much to customize. And we geeks spent a lot of time kind of customizing all this stuff. But in actual fact, if you weren't a geek, it was just complicated. So again, Steve Jobs came along and said, closed system, right? Closed system. I'm not going to give people the option to do all this stuff because you have a more beautiful experience if I don't give you that granular control, because you're going to screw it up. You're not a geek, right? You're not an engineer. You're going to mess this thing up. So I'm going to have a closed system. Yeah, okay, that is a good idea. But without the granularity for security, people have inadvertently sold their data or shared their data, you know, because that's what the app is doing to monetize the app with other applications out there. And that's the problem that we have to solve for, essentially. Yeah.
Mm. So if I understood this correctly, in the future, if you know you get this push this through, which it sounds like, obviously, it sounds like if we can make this work, that would solve a lot of problems, right? Because I want to be able to share my data with the ones I want to share it with, and I don't want to be shared with, you know, with people that are going to do it for something I don't want it to do. That's the whole goal of the project, correct? Yeah. So,
But I think what industry might have to do, so you take that app you just mentioned, that dating app, what they might have to do is say, because fair enough to them, they've built a business model around selling data, like, so this GPS thing that they've been selling that they just got a fine for. So if they've built that model, I think they're going to have to give people two different flavors. And I'm just thinking off the cuff on this right now. Because we can't just point fingers at industry and say, hey, evil, bad. No, that's don't download the app in the first place. Then. It's not
because people love that app. There's a lot of people out there that really love that app, right?
I've been married 25 years, so I haven't been on a date. Exactly. And it's solving problems. I have friends that met online in beautiful exactly. marriages. And that actually, and real introverted friends, especially if I make an observation. So they've solved a problem. And I suspect that the original founding people that came to the table, you know, were beautifully solving a problem for people. Now they've seen, and this is, you know, this is the other side of, you know, this quarterly earnings statement that we have to adhere to in business. It drives productivity and revenue growth every single quarter. And if you get to the end of a hard revenue growth sort of cycle, you've sold all your applications, you've got people sort of just generally now slowly, incrementally joining your application. So all of a sudden, you're not growing at 300%, you're growing at 5%, which is probably normal. But what Wall Street does is it demands massive growth, or you're going to get punished by people shorting their stock. So it turns into this different animal, right? A CEO, a founder creates a beautiful dating app, which is going to connect people together beautifully, let's say. And then all of a sudden they're a publicly traded company. And now you get a CEO that's a real killer in there, and they have to make those, you know, 100% returns every single quarter. Or number one, they're going to lose their job. Number two, the stock's going to get shorted and it's going to drive them down the toilet. And then a competitor's going to come along and either absolve them, right, in an aggressive acquisition on the stock market, you know, or they're just going to get crushed. So that's a problem. Now, to solve for that problem, people start, you know, compromising values, or they start just finding other revenue streams. Ah, there's GPS data for all those people in Norway. If someone's interested in buying that, great, I'm going to sell it. So I suspect that's the journey. So to be fair to those companies, what about this? Why don't we say to people, there's two different flavors of the app. I don't know about these apps. I've been married 25 years. I haven't been on a date in all that time, so I don't need to, right? But if you provide two different flavors, you can say, okay, here's one where it's just wild, wild west. You know, you're going to give up your data. You don't care. And there's some people out there that just don't care. Fair enough.
Free version, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Here's my consent. I'm going to click accept. See you later. I'm not reading these pages. Can't be bothered. All right, fine. Maybe that's $5 a month, or however much this app costs. But then there's other people that might be like you and I, understanding, okay, there's some real danger here. I don't want to share my information. Oh, for you, the secure version of the app, it's $20 a month. Now, that's actually quite an interesting scenario, because some people will complain, because there's always complainers, right? That, well, I'm being punished for the fact that I understand the security protocols and I don't want to share my data. No, you're not being punished. It's not a punishment. It is a... you know, you're privileged with the information, you hold a responsibility for it, and that responsibility comes with cost. Okay, that's the first thing, right? Also, it's the cost is offset by the fact that my data isn't being sold. The other thing it does is it educates the user immediately. So imagine coming to these apps right out the gate, and this to me is the most passionate subject of all, educating the user, right? How do we do that? How do we make sure people understand the consent? If you dip into their pocketbook, people pay attention, right? People don't pay attention with Facebook because it's free, right? It's free. This is why I say complaining about it is like the cow complaining how the steak gets served. You took on this thing, Facebook, and you dumped all your information into it, right? Because it was free. If all of a sudden Facebook said, to use our services is going to cost you, you know, coffee a month, $5 a month. People go, why? Okay, I'm interested now. You've got my attention because my pocket is, you're dipping your hand into my pocket, taking money, right? Or at least asking me. So if all of a sudden Facebook starts costing $5 a month just to access, which, what is that, a billion users? So a billion times five every month? I mean, come on, Facebook, kind of think creatively here. This is not going to damage you. This is only going to increase your profitability. So if they did that, all of a sudden a user starts becoming aware and paying attention. It's the same. It's the age old scenario. You think of somebody who works in a big corporation. When it's not their money and it's the corporate money, they spend freely. You know, they go to the stationery cabinet and they need a pen. They go to the stationery cabinet. They grab a handful of pens. Right? That's just because it's not their money, right? All of a sudden, you need a pen at home. I'm going to go to the local store, the stationery store. I'm going to buy one pen. That's my coin. So you grab people's attention that way. That might be an interesting solution. We'll see.
On this task force, what's the typical meeting like? Is it like a bunch of people sitting around in a room discussing like certain situations where something will be allowed and something shouldn't be allowed? Or like there's a lot of ethics, you know, minded people on these boards. How is that? What are those meetings like?
So the Economic Forum has full-time team members that typically chair or manage the or facilitate the dialogue. And so we'll dial into monthly meetings, and we also have homework to come up with documents that will essentially, you know, guide industry over time. Big meetings coming up in Singapore in August. We'll see if it's in person or not, likely not. And at that point, you deliver on this documentation. So the meetings preceding these big meetings, or at Davos, for example, in Switzerland, typically go, you know, there's guys like me, you know, and there'll be some engineers, there'll be some, you know, types like me that are not engineering types, more business types, let's say, you know, and we essentially just hash out ideas. In my opinion, the more sort of aggressive and combative, the better. Because if we're all agreeing on something, it means we're missing something, you know? And this is why it's nice to have Facebook at the table, whose business is about selling other people's data, right? Because they have to come and disagree with us. We want them to come and disagree with us, right? We need to hear their side of the conversation. So these kinds of conversations should be somewhat combative. Using the word combative, I mean, you know, we're speaking politely and respectfully, of course, but we have to have disagreement, or else we're not solving a problem. We're just coming to the table in unison with some piece of paper that's not going to do anything. And at the end of the day, what we're looking for is a document that basically says, we think this would be interesting. Right. So whether it is what I just said about Facebook charging, you know, $5 for a user to have, let's say, a flavor of Facebook where their data isn't sold, you know, or they can have granularity around their data being sold, because obviously I want them selling the data that I'm a dog owner. I want them to sell that data. Right. So there's granularity in that, and they'll have to figure out that problem. And that's on them. Right. They need to figure out that problem, to be sure. So when we're around this table, we might come to an agreement that basically says, yeah, okay, we're going to build an algorithm that says Eddie is allowing us to sell the fact that he's a dog owner and loves dogs and hates cats, right? He does yoga, but not very well. You know, this kind of stuff, right? It's benign to me, couldn't care less, right? But we are not allowed to, you know, talk about where he works.
When is this task force going to deliver its sort of report or deliver its findings?
August. So August, the meeting there's a meeting in Singapore, and we have to deliver a piece of paper by then. And look, we are just one very tiny piece of a gigantic machine. I mean, you see it in the news all the time, Davos, right, under normal, when it's non-pandemic global lockdowns, you know, they meet over all sorts of things that I just simply have no awareness of. But we're going to be delivering that piece of paper in August. Should be very interesting. And then I will likely serve on another committee.
Mr. Doyle, you have to come back on the podcast, and then we're going to have a discussion about, it's going to be about people and security and communication, and because you got me thinking, well, I don't even remember what I asked anymore. I'm going to go back and watch this and just like make more notes, and I'll get back to you. But thank you so much for your time. Sorry for going over, by the way. I couldn't stop you.
Beautiful. I love it. Don't worry. I'm very grateful. I love the work you're doing, man. I mean, it's really cool. Let's keep awareness out there so we're all in this together. And I appreciate it. And to your audience, I even more appreciate them, because they're tuning in, they're listening, they care. And so, if they can forward this dialogue to others, and people can reach out and find me. I'm easy to find. So it's Edwin Eddie Doyle on LinkedIn. So you type in Edwin Eddie Doyle Manhattan. I'm the only one that comes up. There you go. And I'd love to continue the dialogue, right, in the public forum like that. So, and I'd love to be back, Robbie. So thank you for having me.
As soon as you can travel, come to Norway.
Okay.
Thank you so much for your time. We'll talk soon.
My pleasure.
Well, that's all for today, folks. Thank you for tuning in to the Mnemonic Security Podcast. If you have any concepts or ideas that you'd like us to discuss on future episodes, please feel free to hit me up on LinkedIn or to send us a mail to podcast@mnemonic.no. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.